blah blah.
One, two, three, four, five, six.
Seven FM Acra.
Acra.
Tune in to Quintron's Weather Warlock, a custom-built weather-controlled analog synthesizer that turns the changes in the weather into sounds. New Orleans-based artist Quintron installed one of his series of custom-built weather-controlled analog synthesizers in the Wavefarm Study Center, with sensors outside detecting the differences and changes in the weather. Here, the precipitation, the sunlight, the wind, and the temperature turned into soundscapes anytime, 24 hours a day, at wavefarm.org/listen, or click on the listen button at any WGXC.org page. One of the many web streams available to listen anytime, Quintron's Weather Warlock, available through Wavefarm.
Are you tired of your flying saucer always breaking down on your way to Mars?
Wish you could get more bang for your whoopee at the gas pump?
Well, here at Flying Saucer Mart, we have the perfect flying saucer for you.
It goes as fast as light. It comes in a variety of colors and only costs you 75 whoopee.
Come down to 375 Bionic Ave in Pluto City and fly home with a new used flying saucer today.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of John and...
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies. I just parked my flying saucer. You're listening to me, Norman Douglas, your host of Goodnight Norman, right here on WGXC 90.7 FM, broadcasting to you live from a tower in the beautiful Hudson Valley, and a laptop in the lovely outer boroughs of Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Tonight I got a couple of special friends, even though specialness is weird. The first one is my host this week, not yours, Olivia May Gaughan.
Well, hello, everybody. You're coming up nice wherever you landed tonight. I'm going to read you a short surrealist tale by Leonora Carrington, called The Beloved. One late afternoon, passing through a narrow street, I stole a melon. The fruit man, who was hidden behind his fruit, seized me by the arm and said to me, "Señorita, I've been waiting for an occasion like this for 40 years. I have spent 40 years hidden behind this pile of oranges with the hope that someone would steal a fruit from me. I will tell you why. I need to talk. I need to tell my story. If you don't listen, I will hand you over to the police." "I'll listen," I said. Without letting me go, he took me to the inside of the store among fruits. Without letting me go, he took me to the inside of the store among fruits and vegetables. We shut a door at the far end and we reached a room where there was a bed on which an immovable and probably dead woman lay. It appeared to me that she had been there for a long time since the bed was covered with weeds. "I water her every day," said the fruit man with a pensive air. "In 40 years, I have not succeeded in knowing whether she is dead or not. She has never moved, nor spoken, nor eaten during that time, but the curious thing is that she remains warm. If you don't believe me, look." The man lifted a corner of the cover, which permitted me to see many eggs and some little chicks recently hatched. "As you notice," he said, "I incubate eggs here. I also sell fresh eggs." We each sat down on one side of the bed, and the fruit man began to tell his story. "Believe me, I love her so much. I have always loved her. She was so sweet. She had little agile white feet. Would you like to see them?" "No," I answered. Finally, he continued after exhaling a deep breath, "She was so beautiful. My hair was blonde, hers magnificently black. Now both of us have white hair. Her father was an extraordinary man. He had a mansion in the country. He was a collector of lamb chops. For that, we came to know each other. I have heard about me. He invited me to his house in order to dry his ribs to keep them from rotting. Agnes was his daughter. We loved each other from the first moment. We departed in a boat, by the way, of the Seine. I rowed. Agnes said to me, 'I love you so much that I only live for you.' I answered her with the same words. I believe that is my love which keeps her warm. Perhaps she is dead, but the warmth persists." After a short pause with an absent look, he continued, "Next year I will grow some tomatoes. It wouldn't surprise me if they would grow well there inside. It became night, and I didn't know where we would spend our wedding night." Agnes had become very pale because of fatigue. Finally, we had scarcely left Paris behind when I saw an inn that faced the river. I moored the boat and we walked toward an obscure and sinister terrace. There were two wolves there and a fox who began to walk around us. There was nobody else. I knocked and knocked at the door, on the other side of which a terrible silence prevailed. "Agnes is tired! Agnes is very tired!" I shouted with as much force as I could. Finally, an old lady's head appeared at the window and said, "I don't know anything. The landlord here is the fox. Let me sleep. You are bothering me." Agnes began to cry. There was no other remedy than to direct ourselves to the fox. "Have you beds?" I asked several times. Nobody responded. He didn't know how to speak. And again the head, older than the other, but which now descended slowly through the window, tied to the end of a little cord. "Direct yourself to the wolves. I am not the landlord here. Let me sleep, please." I understood that the head was crazy, and I did not have the heart to continue. Agnes kept crying. I walked around the house a few times, and finally, I was able to open a window, through which we entered. Then we found ourselves in a kitchen with a high ceiling over a large oven made hot by fire with some vegetables that were cooking, and they jumped in the boiling water, a thing that much amused us. We ate well, and then we laid ourselves down on the floor. I had Agnes in my arms. We did not sleep. That terrible kitchen contained all kinds of things. Many rats had stuck their heads out of their holes and then sang with screeching and disagreeable little voices. Filthy odors expanded and diminished one after the other, and there were air drafts. I believed that it was the air drafts that finished my poor Agnes. She never recovered. From that day, each time she spoke less. And the fruit man was so blinded by tears that I could escape with my melon.
Hmm.
That was Olivia May Gone. You're still listening to Goodnight Norman. Our next reader.
Axolotl by Julio Cortázar, translated by Paul Blackburn. There was a time when I thought a great deal about the axolotls. I went to see them in the aquarium at the Jardin des Plantes and stayed for hours watching them, observing their immobility, their faint movements. Now I am an axolotl. I got to them by chance one spring morning when Paris was spreading its peacock tail after a wintry Lent. I was heading down the boulevard Port Royal, and then I took Saint Marcel and L'Hôpital and saw green among all that gray and remembered the lions. I was friend of the lions and panthers, but had never gone into the dark, humid building that was the aquarium. I left my bike against the gratings and went to look at the tulips. The lions were sad and ugly, and my panther was asleep. I decided on the aquarium, looked obliquely at banal fish, until, unexpectedly, I hit it off with the axolotls. I stayed watching them for an hour and left, unable to think of anything else. In the library at Saint Genevieve, I consulted a dictionary and learned that axolotls are the larval stages, provided with gills, of a species of salamander of the genus Ambystoma. That they were Mexican I knew already by looking at them in their little pink Aztec faces and the placard at the top of the tank. I read that specimens of them had been found in Africa, capable of living on dry land during the periods of drought and continuing their life underwater when the rainy season came. I found their Spanish name, ajolote, and the mention that they were edible and that their oil was used, no longer used, it said, like cod liver oil. I didn't care to look up any of the specialized works, but the next day I went back to the Jardin des Plantes. I began to go every morning and afternoon. The aquarium guard smiled perplexedly, taking my ticket. I would lean up against the iron bar in front of the tanks and set to watching them. There is nothing strange in this, because after the first minute, I knew that we were linked, that something infinitely lost and distant kept pulling us together. It had been enough to detain me that first morning in front of the sheet of glass where some bubbles rose through the water. The axolotls huddled on the wretched marrow. Only I can know how narrow and how wretched that floor of moss and stone in the tank. There were 9 specimens, and the majority pressed their heads against the glass, looking with their eyes of gold at whoever came near them. Disconcerted, almost ashamed, I felt it a lewdness to be peering at these silent and immobile figures heaped at the bottom of the tank. Mentally, I isolated one, situated on the right, and somewhat apart from the others, to study it better. I saw a rosy little body, translucent. I thought of those Chinese figurines of milky glass, looking like a small lizard about 6 inches long, ending in a fish's tail of extraordinary delicacy, the most sensitive part of our body. Along the back ran a transparent fin which joined with the tail, but what obsessed me was the feet of the slenderest nicety, ending in tiny fingers with minutely human nails. And then I discovered its eyes, its face, inexpressive features with no other trait save the eyes, two orifices like brooches, wholly of transparent gold, lacking any life but looking, letting themselves be penetrated by my look, which seemed to travel past the golden level and loose itself in a diaphanous interior mystery. A very slender black halo ringed the eye and etched it into the pink flesh, onto the rosy stone of the head, vaguely triangular, but with curved and irregular sides which gave it a total likeness to a statue corroded by time. The mouth was masked by the triangular plane of the face. Its considerable size would be guessed only in profile. In front of a delicate crevice barely slit the lifeless stone. On both sides of the head, where the ears should have been, there grew three tiny sprigs, red as coral, a vegetal outgrowth, the gills, I suppose. And they were the only thing quick about it. Every 10 or 15 seconds, the springs pricked up stiffly again and then subsided. Once in a while, a foot would barely move. I saw the diminutive toes poise mildly on the moss. It's that we don't enjoy moving a lot, and the tank is so cramped. We barely move in any direction, and we're hitting one of the others with our tail or our head. Difficulties arise, flights, fights, tiredness. The time feels like it's less if we stay quietly. It was their quietness that made me lean towards them, fascinated the first time I saw the axolotls. Obscurely, I seemed to understand their secret will to abolish space and time with an indifferent immobility. I knew better later, the gill contraction, the tentative reckoning of the delicate feet on the stones, the abrupt swimming. Some of them swim with a simple undulation of the body, proved to me that they were capable of escaping that mineral lethargy in which they spent whole hours. Above all else, their eyes obsessed me. In the standing tanks on either side of them, different fishes showed me the simple stupidity of their handsome eyes, so similar to our own. The eyes of the axolotls spoke to me of the presence of a different life, of another way of seeing. Gluing my face to the glass, the guard would cough fussily once in a while. I tried to see better those diminutive golden points that entranced to the infinitely slow and remote world of these rosy creatures. It was useless to tap with one finger on the glass directly in front of their faces. They never gave the least reaction. Their golden eyes continued burning with their soft, terrible light. They continued looking at me from an unfathomable depth, which made me dizzy. And nevertheless, they were close. I knew it before this, before being an axolotl. I learned it the day I came near them for the first time. The anthropomorphic features of a monkey revealed the reverse of what most people believe, the distance that is traveled from them to us, the absolute lack of similarity between axolotls and human beings proved to me that my recognition was valid, that I was not propping myself up with easy analogies. Only the little hands. But an eft, the common newt, has such hands also, and we are not at all alike. I think it was the axolotl's heads, that triangular pink shape with the tiny eyes of gold, that looked and knew, that laid the claim. They were not animals. It would seem easy, almost obvious, to fall into mythology. I began seeing in the axolotls a metamorphosis which did not succeed in revoking a mysterious humanity. I imagined them aware, slaves of their bodies, condemned infinitely to the silence of the abyss, to a hopeless meditation. Their blind gaze, the diminutive gold disc without expression and nonetheless terribly shining, went through me like a message. Save us, save us. I caught myself mumbling words of advice, conveying childish hopes. They continued to look at me, immobile, from time to time. The rosy branches of the gills stiffened. In that instant, I felt a muted pain. Perhaps they were seeing me, attracting my strength to penetrate into the impenetrable thing of their lives. They were not human beings, but I had found in no animal such a profound relation with myself. The axolotls were now like witnesses of something, and at times like horrible judges. I felt ignoble in front of them. There were such a terrifying purity in those transparent eyes. They were larvae, but larvae means disguise and also phantom. Behind those Aztec faces without expression, but of an implacable cruelty, what semblance was awaiting its hour? I was afraid of them. I think that had it not been for feeling the proximity of other visitors and the guard, I would not have been bold enough to remain alone with them. "You eat them alive with your eyes, eh?" the guard said, laughing. He likely thought I was a little cracked. What he didn't notice was that it was they devouring me, slowly, with their eyes, in a cannibalism of gold. At any distance from the aquarium, I had only to think of them. It was as though I was being affected from a distance. It got to the point that I was going every day, and at night I thought of them immobile, there in the darkness, slowly putting a hand out which immediately encountered another. Perhaps their eyes could see in the dead of night, and for them the day continued indefinitely. The eyes of axolotls have no lids. I now know that there was nothing strange that had to occur. Leaning over in front of the tank each morning, the recognition was greater. They were suffering. Every fiber of my body reached toward that stifled pain, that stiff torment at the bottom of the tank. They were lying in wait for something, a remote dominion destroyed, an age of liberty when the world had been that of the axolotls. Not possible that such a terrible expression which was attaining the overthrow of that forced blankness on their stone faces should carry any message other than one of pain. Pain, proof of that eternal sentence, of that liquid hell they were undergoing. Hopelessly, I wanted to prove to myself that my own sensibility was projecting a non-existent consciousness upon the axolotls. They and I knew. So there was nothing strange in what happened. My face was pressed against the glass of the aquarium. My eyes were attempting once more to penetrate the mystery of those eyes of gold, without iris, without pupil. I saw from very close up the face of an axolotl immobile next to the glass. No transition and no surprise. I saw my face against the glass. I saw it on the outside of the tank. I saw it on the other side of the glass, my face. Then my face drew back, and I understood. Only one thing was strange. to go on thinking as usual, to know, to realize that was, for the first moment, like the horror of a man buried alive, awakening to his fate. Outside, my face came close to the glass again. I saw my mouth, the lips compressed with the effort of understanding the axolotls. I was an axolotl, and now I knew instantly that no understanding was possible. He was outside the aquarium. His thinking was a thinking outside the tank. Recognizing him, being him himself, I was an axolotl, and in my world, the horror began. I learned in the same moment of believing myself prisoner in the body of an axolotl, metamorphosed into him with my human mind intact, buried alive in an axolotl, condemned to move lucidly among unconscious creatures. But that stopped when a foot just grazed my face, when I moved just a little to one side and saw an axolotl next to me who was looking at me and understood that he knew also. No communication possible, but very clearly. Or I was also in him, or all of us were thinking human-like, incapable of expression, limited to the golden splendor of our eyes looking at the face of the man pressed against the aquarium. He returns many times, but he comes less often now. Weeks pass without his showing up. I saw him yesterday. He looked at me for a long time and left briskly. It seemed to me that he was not so much interested in us anymore, that he was coming out of habit. Since the only thing I do is think, I could think about him a lot. It occurs to me that at the beginning we continued to communicate, that he felt more than ever one with the mystery which was claiming him. But the bridges were broken between him and me, because it was his obsession is now an axolotl, alien to his human life. I think that at the beginning I was capable of returning to him in a certain way, only in a certain way, and of keeping awake his desire to know us better. I am an axolotl for good now, and if I think like a man, it's only because every axolotl thinks like a man inside his rosy stone semblance. I believe that all this succeeded in communicating something to him in those first days, when I was still he. And in this final solitude, to which he no longer comes, I console myself by thinking that perhaps he is going to write a story about us, that, believing he's making up a story, he's going to write all this about axolotls.
Here on Good Night, Norman. Broadcasting to you live from Hillsboro, North Carolina, on WGXC 90.7 FM in beautiful downtown Acre, New York. Our next reader is Kristen Volker.
I'll be bringing you an erotic letter from Exilia Saldana. My faithful one, now I close my eyes and all is night, the night of my body. All is solitude, all is silence, the golden bird of silence, and I enter the aviary of memory. But I enter without memory, like a soldier who after many years returns to a city through which his company once moved. Hardly a sparkle in the diorama of recollection of his own war, that generous forgetting of a liberating vanity which confuses rejections with acclaim, defeats with liberation. I enter discovering what is known, without hatreds, without faults, calmly, without enthusiasms or indifference, without recollections in memory, without nostalgia. Another city and a soldier among thousands and a war like many others, useless, lost even before it was a war, even yet before there were combatants. Nothing united the city and the soldier except the two faces of a slogan so repeated it is forgotten, so eternal it is obsolete. City and soldier came face to face by accident, by the unconscious game of fortune, just as it made you and me enemies by chance. Nothing ties us, nothing, neither pain nor joy, or perhaps this freedom is our most burdensome shackle. Maybe we are slaves to a tenderness that we lost, much like the anonymous soldier and his little town. A hidden town square, the ancient dust of a non-existent corner, a mere lad, tearful and terrified. I am the little soldier who thought himself a hero, the little soldier hungry for exploits who enters into memory, bites his hostile flesh, and gnashing its teeth splits the kernel where a sleeping city waits. No, I do not close my eyes. Rather, I open them. I want to see and see and contemplate. I enter into the memory that I invent for myself with shreds of other memories that I've also invented, with threads of you and of other bodies that you fabricated, an image of all the superimposed images. Distorted glare of the body that I build for you, uninterrupted, for the mirror of my memory. And I enter into memory, touching your feet, the long toes, aristocratic, the transparent toenails with their half moons, with their sensitive soles. I touch your feet, white, almost blue, with the reverse side of my eyes. I memorize them. I take them away with me forever. I leave you cut short, unfinished, like a marble statue corroded by saltpeter. The plundering has begun. Yes, I enter into memory, into each of your particulars, so that your memory can be more you than you yourself, and so that nothing may be left to the hasty improvisation of solitude. And I enter into memory, shackling your ankles with my two hands, fettering your ankles with iron and dreams so that you do not escape. And, trusting, I climb your legs. I dig in my nails. Slowly, I catch hold of the prominence of your knees. I guess the entrance of the back of your knees. I climb up your thighs. I reach your groin leisurely. I survey the distance. I listen to your voice. I see you, invalid child, arched, like a caricature of Praxiteles. I carry you in my arms. I am with you in your mourning tiredness. I carry your frustration, your rage, your envy of other legs which run, swim, skate, mock you. Where's the cripple going who looks here, looks there? Which way did he go then, with his shadow green eyes, with his hazel green mischievous eyes? Where did he go? Whence does he come now with that shifty, inscrutable look? Where is he coming from? Where will he go with his deceptive and sensual hobble? Where is the cripple going who looks here, looks there? I do not know where you were going then, but I am going now to the hip that was already marked, asymmetric, deformed. I go and I stroke myself. I slither, cliff, rough, warm stone, point of whiteness, I go, I caress it, I indulge it, but not so much that I may make your waist jealous. Fine, like a flamenco dancer, almost feminine in the break of the back, almost grotesque in the profile of nakedness, but yours, your waist, and my arms that surround it, my caress, like a penitential shirt that encircles it. I am at the rhythmic equator of your body. I advance as far as your center. I arrive at my goal. And I enter into memory with my arms on high, triumphant, greeting all the women of my race, who from the stands call me victorious. I competed and won. You are my trophy, an eternal effigy, neither child nor man at the frontier, an angel with a single plume, long and silvery. And I enter into memory. But you are not an angel, and you are the guardian of the serpent. The serpent hangs between your legs. The serpent becomes flower. And I enter into memory. I enter marveling at the incredible flower, the mellow flower, the tremulous and unique flower, the ineffable flower, the real flower, the one protected by a fragile curl, delicate, almost non-existent. I have seen the lotus. I know the narcissus. I have tasted of the lilies from the springs, but none is softer, none is purer than this white flower that I rub with my lips, afraid that it will fear me. That I traverse with my tongue, careful that it does not get injured. That I bite carefully with my teeth, taking care that it does not become annoyed. This flower of flesh that I water with my saliva, making sure that it will not wilt on me. And your flower, little by little, it rises, slowly, it rises, timidly, it rises. Its fragile stem opens like a translucent sunflower, looking for the light. A flower made to fall, broken by the breeze, to be depetaled by the wind, to disappear in the tornado's eye. But that will be later, when I will be a hurricane. Now it simply opens. Now it peeks out at the world. Now it dazzles me. Now it moves me. Now it is softness. Now it is my joy. And I relax under the cone of its shade. I am the bee that buzzes, flutters, buzzes, passes by the tormented ribs, stops at the purple place that marks them, rejects the famished flanks, encircles the navel, flies as far as the pink nipples, lands and sucks. I want no taboo. I love in nakedness and cleanliness, in health and in completeness. Rose honey are you for my tongue that zigzags, plunders, buzzes, whirls, buzzes, licks your buttocks and explores caverns, narrow passes, subterranean grottos, where it enters and feels also there, the vibrating seismic pulse of your desire. And I enter into memory, seeing you enjoy in the secret and unconfined female sensibility of the male. And I cover you, a man's mannish woman, a female who possesses, and I enjoy you. In the silence full of foreboding, of ancient fears, the ear of this deaf and implacable hostile ghost hears your nuptial moan. I do not want to hear you. I am not going to have pity on your defeat. I only want to assault your flower, adorn my hair with it, my shoulders, my waist. I want its eternity in pure earth and alive in the faith of the inner side of my inner thighs. But I, only I, and the anxiety of the hills know the duration of the ephemeral life of a flower. And yours, before fruiting, liquefies in my hands, turns into thick dew of the night, curdled foam from the sea of night, milk recently drawn from the udders of the night. And I enter into memory like an abandoned pup. Tell me, how do I harden the stem that sustained it? How do I renew its vanquished juices? Tell me, what do I do with this orphanhood that promenades on your solar plexus, on the meadows of your chest, on your blonde hair, curly and thin? Tell me if you can be moved by my bleeding. And I enter into memory like a lost and hungry buck. Now I whisper to your flower, petal by petal, your phallus, your glands, your testicles, and I run, I run, I run, chased by a pack of panting wolves, and I protect myself in your beard, so that there I may wipe from myself all of the white tears of the night that your flower has been capable of suffering because of my orphanhood. Ah, my young, young man. My unfinished one, my unborn one, my unconquerable one, my magnificent, ugly one. You are perfect in the avarice of yourself, perfect in your egotism with yourself, which receives, is uncoiled, and finds the eternal circle, perfect even in the haughty incontinence that it provides in me, in the disguised indifference, in the weaknesses of a 19th century señorito. Perfect for my taste, for my sensuality, for my sweet tooth, yes, perfect. But I want more. I want it all. I must have it all. And I enter into memory, and I want more. Now I am a vampire. I want the blood from your neck, and more. Your throat, and more. Your chin, and more. Your cheeks, and more. Your nose, and more. The precocious lines of your eyes, and more. Your eyelashes, and more. Your eyebrows, and more. The space between them, and more. Your forehead and its unjust wrinkles, and more. Your temples, and more. Your ears, and more. The nape of your neck, and more. I want your veins, your viscera, your muscles, your glands, your humors, your thoughts. I want your passion, and more. And I enter into my memory, not with your passion, but with mine, with the one for my entire life, with the one that no one provokes or conquers, the one that I bequeath and grow. Because, no apparent logic, no apparent motive, my secret weapon against old age, the renewed accomplice of my eternal youth. Fecund ovum through which I enter into memory in order to kiss the skin that stretches out like a ray of the moon, all light glimmers on you. Skin that, because immaculate, navigates on your collarbones or populates itself, on your shoulders and on your back, of great islands, of freckles, of dark archipelagos, on which I go, disembarking my mouth, sailing around them with my nipples, traversing through them until I arrive at the insignificant keys of your thighs. A skin that stands on end like an albino cat at a nail scratch, a skin that crackles like white fire, a skin washed in bleach, a skin whitened with lime, a skin that smells of skin. And I enter into memory, tortured by the aroma of your skin. I enter into memory because I would be lost if your smell did not exist. The entire night would be any instant if it were not filled with your odor. Your body would be my enemy if it did not exhale your odor. My vigil would turn into a nightmare if I did not keep watch over your odor. I am an animal of prey that tracks you to retrieve the quarry of your odor. And I arrive at it. I inhale and verify that the bird of my hunger is your breath. Listen, if someday I should die, which I doubt, rescue me from the earth. Breathe on the void of my cavities. Set them out to dry. Revive me. Kill death with your breathing so that life may sew us stitch by stitch, eternally united to me, mouth to mouth. And I enter into memory, convinced that the eternity of your mouth is the path to the species. I pledge to discover the new world of your mouth, to conquer it, to invade it, to colonize it. To no one will you give this mouth. To no one, because I am its owner. Because if I want it, I erase it with my kiss. Because if I want, I remake it with my kiss. Because if I do not kiss it, it does not exist. Your mouth does not exist outside my kiss. I renounce everything except your mouth. I forget everything except your mouth. I forgive you everything except your mouth. Now that it is mine, I hate the ephemeral flower of your phallus and your neck of ambiguous gestures and your color, your odorous mouth, liquid, thick, red, exact, soft, importunate, giving. It annuls everything. It transforms everything. And if I need it to swallow me, let it be chaste, let it be obscene, let it die, let it pant, let it not be felt, let it be still, let it cry, let it bite, let it caress, let it be vulgar, let it be naive, let it suck me, let it rub me, let it lick me, let it squeeze me, let it crunch me, let it release me, let it gestate me, let it abuse me, let it oblige me, let it vanquish me, let it ask me, let it beg me, let it die for me. And if exhausted in your calling, you no longer had a mouth with which to come with me, then I would enter into the memory of your mother, and I would find the memory of your father, and I would look for the coupling in which they engendered you, and I would enter into the coupling in which they engendered you, and I would oblige them to make your mouth once more. And this new mouth, I will touch with the soft skin of my fingers, so that it may half open and protest as if shaken by a storm of a thousand lightnings, just as I do with this one, and as with this one I will close my eyes, and I will traverse its tongue, teeth, pelvis, clitoris, and I wet it with the oil of my vagina, and I will make it swallow my urine, my perspiration, my words, my color, because it can do it all. It is the antidote of all the venoms and all the injustices. It can clip the wings of the powerful. It can spring the innocents from prison, catechize the atheist, unbaptize the apostles, exercise the witches' sabbats, legitimize the devil, or be God. It can be more than God. Your mouth is the earth, the tired and lazy earth, the entire earth, full when it lies down on the horizon, and there is in your mouth the infinity of the birth and death of the sun. I am the sun. I shed splendor over you, and I illuminate you so that night may become the fire serpent of the unfinished kingdom of the gods. And I enter into memory because only myths have the gift of that which is unwithering. I enter into memory to share with you the privilege of loving. I enter into memory to teach you the humility of loving. I enter into memory so that you may learn the generosity of loving. Loving with all the bodies hidden from the body, loving you in the flesh of the spirit, or in the spirit of the flesh, or in neither one of them, and in both without difference. And I enter into memory shaking, naked, and jeweled with tears, so that you also may be able to become naked and to cry. This is our last chance, the last act of pity that is given to us. And I enter into memory, looking for your hands, the blind person's wisdom of your hands, the goldsmith's fineness of your hands. I enter so that you may plunder me as I plunder you, so that you may steal me as I steal you, so that you may profane me as I profane you. I enter to be more me than I myself in the tracing of blood of my memory. I place your hands so that you may be a man, and the arms so that they sustain them, and the well of the armpits where your odor of rough waters is pacified. I enter into memory in spite of your musty flower, in defiance of your indolent lover's convalescence, opposed to the heaviness of your lids, against the grain of languid incompetence, because at least I trust the courtesy of your hands of an artisan, of mead, of ambrosia, of wine, of roast meat, a festival for my insatiable farm laborer's appetite. And I enter into memory and make your hands enter into the feast that is mine and yours. And I enter into memory and your hands traverse my Angolan's sugarcane feet, my sluggish heels, my ordinary feet, and my untamed ankles and my sumptuous silk cotton tree legs and my crude sugar curves and my conga hutia thighs and my star apple nougat buttocks and my painful back and my sugar mill breasts and my worn out lungs and my gunny sack bronchia and my raw sugar shoulders and my nape of kahune palm and my thick cane syrup ears and my trumpet wood hair and my forehead pregnant with specters and apparitions and my mistaken eyes and my banana tree gnome owl nose and my mamey mouth and my wild tobacco throat and my frying pan hips and my breadfruit belly, and my multicolored rag waist, and my runaway calabash belly button, and the triangle of prestidigitation and jungle hair, and the reverse of the diligent conch shell with its black and iridescent pearl, and the savory consecrated oil in its bronze oil maker, and my breasts of honey and cinnamon and anise. And your hands traverse the repeated unison of my breasts, and your hands traverse the brown naivete of my breasts, and your hands simply traverse my breasts, and they touch, they feel, scrape, ungulate, and I am a pulsating harp that vibrates, a painful concert of chords, a Gregorian danzon, a mystic rumba, a guagonco. I am the inaudible note of the music of the spheres. And your hands and your mouth and your smell and your skin and your bones and your muscles and your blood and your humors and your dead and resurrected flower and your whole body discover what suffering is. the agony of surrender of a being that enfolds like a cyst, like an enemy, before a body that escapes, they discover my body, this honey-colored body that is the body of destiny, of premonitions, of fatality. Finally, you discover what hunger is, and your hands look for my hands, and your hands find my hands. And I enter into memory with my hands held together with your hands as if praying. I enter repeating the supplication of echo. I enter in the mass of the couple. I enter into memory officiating with sacerdotal tamarind milk, with a nipple of custard apple and gratings of medlar, and you suck plenitude and emptiness, pomposity and serenity. I scream, I groan, and you scream and groan, and butterfly and whore in my woman, and come and enter, and flesh of my flesh, and blood of my blood, and sweat of my sweat, and spit of my spit, and little it matters my age or my ugliness or the beauty of my countenance in order to give a grace a chance and the cosmic circle, because among myriads and myriads of combinations it was possible that I be a woman and that you be a man and that we meet at this exact moment, at the precise instant, and yes, one on top of the other, yes, and outside the other, yes, inside each other, yes, recently invented, yes, recently expelled from all Edens, yes, spinning from chaos to eternity, yes, spinning, yes, black and white, yes, spinning, yes, two-headed monster, yes, spinning, becoming one, yes, spinning, yes, suspended, yes, spinning, yes, free, yes, spinning, yes, falling, yes, spinning, yes, floating, yes, spinning, yes, energy, yes, spinning, yes, going, yes, spinning, yes, coming, yes, coming, yes, coming, yes, 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 enough. Once and once more, enough. Yes, enough. Coming, enough. Yes, enough. Yes, enough. Yes, once and again, enough, enough, enough. Until peace, enough, enough. And I enter into memory, and it is peace. And I leave memory, and it is peace. The wolves of the breast have died. The howling of the stones have found peace. The eyes of the peacock were petrified. It is peace. Finally, it is peace. And I enter into memory of yesterday to cross, like the little soldier, the last street of the town. Danger is over. The world signs and executes the light of words. The mirror migrates to its other side. It is the memory prior to the beginning. The die is cast. Whoever you may be, whomever you may have been, whoever you may become, you are, for me, nothing more than a specter of the reincarnated body in my solitude, twin body to my shadow, the kind that the gods serve themselves and with which they challenge me in the enigma of this eternal night, the night in which I imagine your dream, when all is darkness and I enter into my own memory of memory.
All right, this is your host again, Norman Douglas. That was Kristen Volker. Before that was Emilio Tarrio. Before that you heard Olivia May Gone. I guess we have a few minutes left here. Not too many. I'm going to read what I've never done before. My own writing. Because it's short, and I didn't realize that we would go under time. Anyways, look back. Intransitive verb to loiter aimlessly or idly. To loaf, relax, hang out. The instant the eyes open, they close. The ears have a chance to give a listen around. The hiss of the embers, the quiet through the windows occasionally punctuated by the soughing of tires on wet asphalt beyond trees that surround the meadow by the water where the peepers grow quieter and the graying of the morning at night's end. A listening that puts aside a thought of going to buy groceries, and pushes down the phony need to consider calling mom, and sighs to forget about seeing a friend who isn't here when the bed is soft enough and warm enough and close enough to every inch of the skin to simply lay there with the shoulder blades cushioned like wings captured by a neighborly wind that carries nothing too far or too fast. Toes wriggling at the bedclothes' undersides as prelude to stretching one limb before next, just far enough to draw them back into a curl that leans onto one side for a breath, rushing effortlessly deeper than a sigh that drifts the dream of life almost awakened off for a further bout of soporific bliss. And now the sun is high, and so is the moon. But there's no one who asks the planets for whereabouts when the air keeps hanging around with a detailed plan to stave off of hunger that will come if this doesn't feel so easy to chill later, when time starts ticking off impulses to try what a little patience nullifies, left to its own devices, without interference from morphologies of angst and desire, returned to dismiss the boundless energy a want reflects. No one is telling stories of tales that can't be told by chaos bird songs, unsung melodies, chorales to scores no less or greater than this overhearing, freed of looking to make a giant step outside or in or over. And now the grass is a carpet, and the clothes are ragged and loose, and the streaks that dart across the bright blue day that shuts the eyelids overfulfilled with light, playing at dragonfly or hummingbird or buzzing bee and blue fly, tuned in to the cicadan harmonies entwined through toad and grasshopper gripping the bowspringing fronds, ripple ripshod over gold and fields of haw. All this because you're listening to Goodnight Norman on WGXC 90.7 FM, broadcasting to you live from Acre, New York. If you're not asleep by now, I don't know what to tell you. Maybe you need a pill. I'm really grateful to my host here, Olivia Magon. I guess it's not self-promotion to say that we did a fabulous show. And if you weren't there, then you're a square. But it was great. Amelia played with my balls, our balls, since it was a team effort. Olivia sang deftly and played music keenly. Or maybe she sang keenly and played music deftly. And Kristen was there providing moral and intellectual and emotional and psychic and other metaphysical types of support. Looks like I'm going to do a lot of readings around the East Coast for the next foreseeable couple of months. So if anybody cares or listens, that information will be available. I'm really trying to drag out this last minute here. But anybody want to say anything? Tell the name of the stories. What were the name of stories and writers you read again? Olivia, read Leonora Carrington, The Beloved. Mm-hmm. Emilio read Julio Cortázar's Axolotl.